I guess I called you to tell you something. And you're saying, well, why do you feel that I have to hear it?
It's been a difficult day. I'm impatient.
It's not a long story. It's a trivial little thing. I think you'll enjoy. And it may cheer you up.
You're not interested now, I feel. You just want to tell your story. I was beginning to launch into a kind of explication.
I'd like to hear that because you never really talk about yourself. That's always been my problem with the various psychoanalysts and psychiatrists and psychiatric social workers I visited. They never talk about themselves.
That's kind of the role that I feel I've been playing in your life, actually.
Well, I mean, I've invited you to talk about yourself, and you always refuse when you're nearing a deadline. And I say, tell me about this or tell me about that. So you've had a rough day.
I've had more than a rough day, but I've been thinking...
You never call me just to tell me, because, this is a kind of professional relationship, isn't it?
Why don't you just tell me what you've been telling me?
I'd love for you to hear about your rough day.
No, you're not interested. Every time I begin to talk about myself, you interrupt me and go back to yourself. I'm used to this now. It's been very hurtful.
The truth is, every time I try to talk about you, you insist on going back to me.
And every time I do talk about me, you insist on going back to you.
Wow, this is a conundrum. Another great Hollywood story about the difference between New York agents and Hollywood agents. Do you know that story?
No.
The New York agent would say, Larry Block, wow, what a talent. What a fantastic talent. What range. What versatility. Big, big talent. I love him. And the California agent would say, Larry Block, magnificent. Range, versatility, charisma. He's one of the most fabulous actors out here. He loves me. I called to just tell you, and then let me finish my thing, and then, because I know you're just yanking my chain, as they say, and I hate cliches like that, such as at the end of the day.
Well, then don't use them.
But I did, and at least I'm sensitive, when, my thing is, I got a residual check in the mail today. This is in keeping with the little saga of Larry Block in Hollywood, which I know you're developing for a 19-part public radio series. Which would be introduced by Garrison Keillor. Joe.
Yeah.
Can I tell you this quick story and then we'll talk about you if you would dare to?
Mm-hmm.
I got a check in the mail today.
Why can't we talk about me first?
Okay, go.
No, I don't want to.
No, go.
No, you talk.
You mean you didn't really want to talk about
me? Well, I did, but you took the pleasure out of it. You took the joy out of it.
That's not fair.
Achieved considerable success very early on in your life when you were 20 years old as a fashion designer, and that success took place in Japan, where
it took place originally here, Joe, and then the Japanese took me over there and created me over there from scratch.
And so you became a star in Japan.
Yeah.
And you said something about the way they wanted you to present yourself.
In my contract, where I was to be platinum blonde and blue-eyed and tan.
And did you have blue eyes?
I have naturally green eyes, but I had blue contacts.
And your hair was dyed platinum blonde?
Platinum blonde, yeah. I was using hair dye over there, and it burned the hell out of my head and my hair. I was basically tethered to this company in the way that contractually, they had set it up where I could not do anything fashion-wise here because they just kept opening more and more stores as well as in-store boutiques. This is just such an enormous company, Joe, that even though my thing was quite large, I had no say in any of this. I got up every morning. There was a typed sheet of paper. 8 o'clock in the morning, a limousine would pick me up. 9 in the morning, I had a meeting with maybe a company that would manufacture some of my fabrics. 10 o'clock, I would make a personal appearance at one of my shops. 11 o'clock, I'd make another personal appearance at one of my shops. 12 o'clock, I would, be doing maybe a television show. We would break for lunch. 1, I would work with the staff on some of the clothes and, blah, blah, blah. I was a puppet there.
But you were designing the clothes.
I was designing the concepts. My concepts were, for example, I had based one collection on the Sibelius tone poem, Tapiola, it's called. It was this beautiful piece of music about the Finnish wood nymph. Well, you know, obviously that was a winter collection. And there was 700 pieces per season, five seasons a year. It was an enormous amount of work also. You know, I had agents and managers and lawyers and these business advisors. They just raped me. I'm not a businessman, you know, I'm a creative person. My manager was taking money and redecorating his apartment. And I went to the president of the company, who, you know, this enormous conglomerate, and explained to him, you know, these things are happening, they're not right. That's what blew it, for some odd reason. You're not supposed to make waves over there. And although I was alerting him to the fact that these wrongdoings were occurring and they were only screwing up the momentum of the business, which was doing really well. I mean, we were grossing almost $90 million a year. I mean, my name brand was. The man that had managed my business had a weekday mistress and a weekend wife and kids in the suburbs, you know, of Tokyo. The wife was miserable, which happens frequently. And when they are as miserable as she gets and decides to take her life, it's dishonorable to take one's life without taking the children along with her.
So she killed herself and her children?
Yeah. And that really is what did the company in. Then this guy came along and thought, huh, let's start up a menswear company. Well, I did start it up with this person, and it was tremendously successful for a while, and then it wasn't. It's very difficult to be in this style business. The people are so vacuous, and it really has so little to do with creativity. It really all has to do with business. And I was working very hard and working long hours, and I did develop this. Started taking speed, you know. I mean, not on a recreational basis. I mean, I just needed to stay awake. It had gotten to the point with speed that I was extremely paranoid. Wherever I went, I thought that the FBI was following me, and that I had these great ideas. I thought they were the most marvelous things. You know, a poncho for lovers, which was just one huge piece of a nylon square with two hoods, and then it could turn into a menage a trois poncho with three hoods, and an orgy poncho with eight hoods. You know, just ridiculous ideas. And at the same time, also seeing, you know, nooses coming out of windows. From the top of a window, I would see these nooses that, you know, I thought, Jesus Christ.
So I was thinking of going down and purchasing a handgun. This is my latest fantasy. Bring it back to my house. And, you know, I'm terribly afraid of death, but at the same time, I just don't want to keep on thinking. So the idea is to fire off rounds into my lawn and then quickly, maybe having drunk a half a bottle of vodka or something, then turn the gun on myself and just take a quick shot.
Have to warm up to it by firing into the lawn.
Exactly. I'd have to just sort of get into the feel of it, and then maybe I might be able to just swing it around real quickly before I'm really ready for it, and then just take a shot, and then you wouldn't have anybody to berate you, degrade you the way I've been. Yeah.
Well, that's why friends like me can only, the only way of...
You can only hope that I keep on living.
Well, I'm afraid that's true. What other kind of clear and rational reason could I give you for not ending your life, other than it would be a great loss for me financially, and to a certain extent I would have no one to talk to, and I would be sad on a number of levels.
We had an enormous show in New York. It was very well received, and then in 6 weeks the company was closed.
Because
the collection was actually a very high-end men's collection. You're very hard to find a sales rep to sell those, the kind of clothes that I was designing. And we found a rep who turned out was taking the samples and swapping them for blowjobs on 42nd Street, hustlers. So there was no sample line left. And so we were getting orders from department stores, but then they would want to see the line again. And then there was no line, and no one could find this guy. It was just absurd, absolutely absurd.
Family pain is common throughout our culture, and spiritual communities often draw those with a painful family history. Spiritual seekers may come for release, to heal, or to find a way to transcend the troubles they carry within. This is not true of students alone. Most Western spiritual leaders, meditation teachers, monks, nuns, and clergy also carry deep family wounds. They too may have initially hoped that spiritual detachment and peace would release them from dealing with family pain. But one Chinese Chan master cautions, don't confuse non-attachment and freedom with running away. Your idea of leaving your family and children to renounce the world is like running from your shadow. We cannot escape the fact of our family background and the wounds it inflicts. We so easily become judgmental of one another. Sometimes the closer we are to a person, the stronger our judgments and frustrations can become. That is why family is one of the final frontiers of spiritual development. One former Hindu Swami told me, after my years of yoga in India, I came back to teach and marry. Later, I became head of a temple. My samadhi experiences showed me the bliss of all things. Over time, I got busy, and I started to lose it, to tell you the truth. I tried to meditate more to get it back. We had conflict in the temple, and in my marriage we fought, sometimes quite terribly. Some days, I wondered if I should ever try to practice in this worldly life. Even meditation was not giving me much help. One day, I was visiting my family and taking care of my young nephew. It was a hard day for the Swami and the three-year-old. We messed up the house, he threw a tantrum. Finally, I took him in my arms and just held him. I sang Sanskrit melodies, and I realized that's all the world wants, to be held in spite of it all. The bliss and samadhi came back as soon as I opened my heart. Family is a mirror. In our spouses, our lovers, our parents, and children, we find our needs and hopes and fears writ large. Intimate relations reach in and touch our history without anesthesia. The wounds we carry, the longings we have to be nourished, are right on the table.
Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
Young and muscular and fancy free.
That sounds like the title of a gay porn film.
It was just a working title, Joe. It was not...
I would never describe myself as fancy-free. I just wouldn't
use... fancy-free is, again, that's like at the end of the day, or in my judgment. Let's say I was young and crazy.
It's more like it.
And I'm about to sneeze. Thank you. So, my friend, she said, why don't you go to my therapist? She's quite old. She lives on Park Avenue. And
this was a therapist you'd had sex with, the one who recommended
No, I did not have sex with her. We had become friends. She let me sleep in her office at night.
When you told me that at one point she came in and you drank together and...
We drank together and smoked grass together, and she thought I was really a hot, sexy young actor, and she thought it would be really wild if we just had this affair, and I would live there, and she would come to me, and we would be together, and she really liked me, and liked my energy, and wanted to do drugs with me, and... Just as we were about to embrace, I said, it just doesn't feel right. She said, that's okay.
And then you slept with her daughter.
I did.
Yeah. And how did that happen?
Well, the daughter was, when I first met and became a patient of this psychologist, she had a daughter. She was living unhappily somewhere in Rockland County or Westchester County, one of these counties north of here, with a husband who was also a psychologist. And then there came a point, as we became friends more, I met her daughter, who was at the time about 14. And the daughter, I was at that time probably about 31 or 32 or something like that.
Were you already sizing up her daughter?
Not for a moment. She was 14 years old.
It would have been disgraceful and outrageous had you been. But no such thought ever crossed your mind.
Not the slightest thought at all.
She was just a young girl.
She was a young, interesting, funny girl, and I enjoyed being with them both, and I understood their situation, that the mother was living with her psychologist husband, and they were living apart. They had separate bedrooms, and it was, you know, a big house somewhere in Croton on Hudson or something.
Well, how did they explain this to the daughter? I mean, the separate bedroom thing. I mean, that's a little bit...
They were very modern, Joe.
What makes that modern?
They were both sort of hip psychologists, and they decided they could live together.
Did they have an open marriage?
Yeah, I would presume so. I don't know, because I was not opening, but I think they did. They had independent lives, and they lived in the same house, and they stayed together because they cared for their daughter, and they made an arrangement. They were modern, they were logical, and they were civil with each other.
So, going back to the daughter, so you were...
So, when I met the daughter through the mother, we all became friends, and the daughter was a delightful, precocious young gal, and... So we just all became friends, and in the next 4 years, this friendship continued.
The friendship with the mother?
With both of them. The mother and the daughter, and the three of us together, we just hung out, you know, we were friends. Well, there came a point when the daughter turned 18, and I was in California, had been there for a year or so, and I came back to New York, and we had talked on the phone. And we had, you know, as she got older, we became more connected. She was a senior in high school. I came back from California, and it turned out that her mother was going to be out of town, and by this time they had an apartment in the city. And I actually met her outside of her private high school on a Friday afternoon and hung out, and I had beers and stuff, and I don't think she drank anything. We went back to the apartment where her mother lived and made love. And it was very wonderful. I went back to California a few weeks later, and that was the only time we made love, that weekend.
And when you made love that weekend, was there any talk of a relationship, or what was the sense of what it all meant, if it meant anything?
We're talking about the mid-70s, maybe 76, 77. Pre-AIDS, and also kind of at the tail end of hippiedom and open, casual sexuality.
So that's what this was about. This was casual sex.
Absolutely.
When it was over and you went back to California and looked back on it, did you ever have a feeling that there was something inappropriate or filthy about what you'd done with her?
No, no, no. I was not the first man she made love to.
Is that the relevant point? I mean, if she's made love to anybody else, then it's really okay to...
I felt that she was open to...
You weren't filled with self-loathing or disgust?
Not the slightest. I felt no guilt, of course, and I was sorry that we didn't stay in touch, but I was in California, and I'm sure I haven't, you know, talked to her or her mother, you know, for 25 years, whatever amount of years it was.
You know, there was a time when I saw an old shrink, and I mean a man in his 80s, I guess, and he was hearing impaired. And so he had a microphone on a stand in front of your chair, and he had a wire going from that microphone into his ears. He was wearing a headphone set. And so when you spoke, you would be speaking directly into his ears through the microphone. But he could never get the adjustment quite right. Either you'd be talking too loud, which would be jarring to him, and he'd wince, and he'd say, please lower your voice. Or you'd lower your voice, and then his eyelids would begin to droop, and you had a feeling that he was drifting off into some world of dreams or fantasies, because he couldn't hear you.
He charged a lot of money.
A fortune.
We were talking about shrinks. And
right.
I told you that the mother of this girl, this old woman by now, 70-year-old woman, I mean, that's really the fun of it. Listen, I go to visit the shrink on Park Avenue.
At the recommendation of
my shrink friend. She says, go see my shrink. She's very old. And this all comes out of your old timer with the microphone and everything. So I say, okay, I'll go see her. I don't know. I'm just lost. I want to switch to the bedroom so I can have a shot of Dewars and a little beer, okay?
You can't do that on the other phone?
No, because the other phone is in the bedroom and I'm in the kitchen now.
Okay.
Reaching up into the closet for my half pint of Dewars.
I thought your half pint of Dewars was in the back of the freezer.
I keep the Kettle One in the back of the freezer.
Oh.
I find vodka such an unattractive drink that I decided to switch to a combination of Dewars scotch and a wonderful beer called Honey Brown.
Are you back on the other phone now?
Yeah.
I was in a supermarket and I bought a Bacardi rum mixed with tropical juices. And
a big one? A little one?
Big one. Because it was the only one that was there. And boy, it was delicious. It was
Did
so...
Did yesterday?
No, it was about a few days ago. And I went to my mother's and sat there and had my dinner as she sat in the dark by the window. And I got so wonderfully high.
Yeah.
And nothing mattered to me.
Yeah.
I didn't care. It's a beautiful thing not to care.
The summer that I did Comedy of Errors in Central Park, which was probably the highest point of my life.
When you were there with Ted Danson and...
Ted Danson and Danny DeVito and had the relationship with that famous actress and another near-famous actress, and then a less unknown, but three amazing sexual encounters within a four-week period that were just the high point of my life. And I was starring in this...
And these are actresses whose names are recognizable, women who
one,
are stars.
One readily, the second not so readily, and the third is a professor of theater at Rutgers. She's the one I would probably go to if the three of them came back to me again. But it was a pretty amazing, within 1 week, I had sexual romance with these three beautiful women, that I was doing a great role. I guess it was the high point of my life. It was the kind of summer where I was riding a lot on my bicycle. And one of the joys of my life, among all the other joys, because I was free, nothing mattered. Everything was good, you know?
You were not seeking therapy or counseling or...
Only for the deepest existential questions.
I don't follow this. Here you're telling me that you need to drink or to take a medication or you need help because you're so depressed about the downward trajectory of your life. And yet at the same time, it seems to me, from what I can gather, is that misery accompanied you every step of the way, even when you were at doing your best and succeeding quite well. There was, as you put it, existential despair. Is that true?
I thought I was sad then, but...
But that doesn't compare to what you are now.
Of course, in the context, or rather in the perspective of aging, of getting older, the things that made you miserable, 20 years ago, the things that defined your life as being lost and tragic are...
The thing that's interesting to me about the question of misery is whether, in fact, things really are not any worse than they were before, really, emotionally. They felt as bad way back when as they feel now, but somehow you feel that now it's worse than it was then, when in point of fact you may have been, in a different way, just as sad and just as lost and just as troubled as you are today.
Let me finish about the shrink on Park Avenue that I went to visit.
Okay.
So, she sets it up, my friend, Portia, the mother of Carol. She sets up a meeting with her shrink, mm-hmm. who's an older woman. And she lives on Park Avenue. And I got on my bicycle that summer's day. And I put on my my work jeans. You know, the kind of strap jeans, kind of work jeans, farmer jeans? That's what I wore in the summer. I wore no top, no t-shirt, anything, just a pair of work jeans and some sandals. And I rode my bicycle.
Birkenstocks.
May well have been Birkenstocks at that time.
I wouldn't be caught dead in a pair of those things. I can't believe that you ever wore them. But I can't believe you wore them.
I guarantee you that outfit that
really
I might have worn.
You really were fancy free.
But I'm telling you, Joe, even though you can't believe it, I'm telling you that when I showed up for rehearsal for Comedy of Errors, because it may have well been the same summer, when I showed up for rehearsal with my jeans, with the strap, those clipped jeans and a pair of Birkenstocks, being really thin as a rail,
So there's a certain sexual ambiguity about you when you appeared at Shakespeare in the Park.
Don't call me androgynous or sexually ambivalent, because somewhere in the 70s, I was riding my bicycle across Central Park with a pair of farmer jeans and no top, because that would be a mistake. I was riding across Central Park in the middle of one of the hottest days of the summer, and these four guys dressed totally in black with black hats, as I rode past them, said, "Are you Jewish?"
What made them think that you might be Jewish?
This is one of the burdens of our race, Joe. I don't know. Maybe they were out fishing. When you're out fishing, you troll for anyone. For some reason, they said, "Are you Jewish?" I don't look that Jewish, but maybe I did that day. But they said, "Are you Jewish?" And I jammed on my brakes, and I said, "Yeah, why?" And they said, "Would you like to lay tefillin with us?"
You change phones again.
For practical purposes.
You're drinking.
But I'm almost finished with that.
Well, what are you doing? You're drinking Doers?
I'm in the kitchen. I'm having a little honey beer and a shot.
A little honey brown and some Doers.
And a Doers. But Joseph, how they knew I was Jewish, I don't know.
Are you going to switch to the other phone?
I am.
Or are you not finished yet?
No, I'm ready. I don't know how they knew I was Jewish, and it didn't matter, but they took a chance. And they were sweating, they're wearing black frock coats, and...
What time is this?
2:00 in the afternoon.
Okay.
And they had a beautiful little velvet bag. Did you have a velvet bag for your bar mitzvah?
Yes, I remember a velvet bag, and I remember these articles that were given to me that were terrifying to me, to tell you the truth.
Right from the beginning?
The thing about the thing for me was I did not want to be bound and tied by these straps and
Well, when I met those guys in the park, I thought the idea of wrapping Tillin around my arm and about my head was one of the most fabulous theatrical moments I could imagine. And I get off my bicycle in the middle of the sheep meadow, and they pull out this velvet bag, and they take out the Tillin. And I thought it was wildly theatrical for me to be wrapping these straps around my arm, you know, in the middle of Central Park on a Wednesday afternoon. And I followed them in the prayer, and they said, "Will you join us in Brooklyn on next Wednesday for a Torah meeting?" And I said, "I can't promise, but I think I probably will." And I thanked them for sharing their tefillin with me, and I rode off. And at some point after that, I was in a bathtub with that actress that I told you about.
Yeah.
And she said, "I love your arms." And I said, "Can I tell you a story about my right arm? There was a time before this when I was riding across Central Park, and these Hasidic Jews asked me if I was Jewish and if I wanted to lay tefillin with them. And I got off my bike and I said, sure. But as they wrapped these straps around my right arm, I realized that it was a different right arm than when I was 13 years old, because by then I was 30. And instead of those scrawny little pale arm, I had my man arm, which was muscular and had hair on it. That was the story I told her about my arm, because that was what I felt when I laid the tefillin 17 years later.
What was the meaning, the deeper meaning of that?
It meant nothing to me when I was 13, and it meant nothing to me when I was 31.
But it meant a lot to you in the bathtub with the beautiful actress.
It meant a lot to me because she found it fascinating, and we had the most passionate sex we'd ever had. I was not the first man.
Jewish man.
Not the first Jewish man that she had coerced into telling experiences of laying tefillin.
Was she laid tefillin on you? Or
no, what? She made me lay tefillin on her to wrap the tefillin around her, to bind her. She had a set of phylacteries in her apartment, and I had to wrap the tefillin around her. And that was.
Does she only have one pair of phylacteries, or does she have a?
Well, I was going to get into the fact that she had some strange, sort of exaggerated set of phylacteries in which the leather strap was about 4 or 5 feet long, and it wasn't just designed for an arm. She asked if I would lay the tefillin around her leg, starting at her ankle and running up to her thigh, and placing the little box.
The box containing the Torah.
No, not the Torah.
I thought it contains scripture, doesn't it?
The Torah is a big book.
I thought it was the Torah written in microscopic print.
No, no, no. That's a fancy notion, but that's not what it is. It's excerpts from the Torah.
No.
She wanted the little box with the scripture pressed against her vagina.
Not placed inside it, but
no,
it.
No, she just wanted the phylactery wrapped from her ankle to her groin, and I was requested by her to enter her lifting up the little box so that the box rested on my
penis.
You know, the way the box
I know of couples who've actually used the Torah itself as an area for lovemaking, and people will open up the Torah.
You know, stretch it out on the living room floor,
stretch it out,
and make love on the Torah.
And then roll themselves up in the Torah, and then make love amidst the...
You mean with the Torah surrounding them and over them?
Sort of wrapped around them. It's,
yeah,
similar to the phylacteries, only in this case it's a very large scroll.
That's very heavy, though.
Very religious.
Because
very spiritual.
It's very spiritual, but the thing that bothers me about it is that it's only the Michael Eisner, the Jeffrey Katzenbergs and Spielbergs that can afford their own Torahs, because they don't just get the kind of Torah you can get at Kmart. They get Torahs by the real masters, you know, that are produced in the Holy Land, in Bethlehem or Jerusalem or wherever. And these Torahs go for what? $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 for a Torah. Am I not mistaken?
Oh, yeah.
So that kind of sex is rarefied.
Yeah, transcendent. And
I'm sure it is, but I'm troubled by it because it's the Spielberg, Katzenberg, Geffen. Geffen, of course, and Calvin Klein made love in a Torah. But the ordinary person can't do that.
The community of the sacred is revered in Judaism as the minyan, the minimum number of Jews needed for a prayer service. It is the sacred communion of the Sufis, the satsang of Hinduism, and the holy Christian love whenever two or more are gathered in his name. However it may be expressed, true community is central to spiritual life. From isolation to community. One old Hasidic rabbi asked his pupils how they could tell when the night had ended and the day had begun, for that is the time for certain holy prayers. Is it, proposed one student, when you can see an animal in the distance and tell whether it is a sheep or a dog? No, answered the rabbi. Is it when you can clearly see the lines on your own palm? Is it when you can look at a tree in the distance and tell if it is a fig or a pear tree? No, answered the rabbi each time. Then what is it? The pupil demanded. It is when you can look on the face of any man or woman and see that they are your sister or brother. Until then, it is still night.
Take the photos to
the immigration.
Right. So I'm left with this fucking goat. You know, these drunks, they're either benevolent or belligerent, you know, depending on how hammered they are.
I had been drinking, not a lot, you know, you probably were. I was drinking while we were talking.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a wonderful, vibrant conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I drank a small bottle of Dewars, you know, just the what I call the child-sized bottle,
mm-hmm.
and a beer, and then, of course, they came home, and, you know, I wasn't acting in any kind of drunken way, but it was clear that I had been drinking from the smell of the alcohol, and so I got, you know, I was... You know, kind of persecuted by Jolly and Zoe, and Zoe was very disappointed and disgusted. Jolly was disgusted and disappointed. And then a little later on, Jolly was saying, "Oh, you smell, your breath smells like a drunk." I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "Why don't you just go somewhere? Just get out." So I left. But like I say, since I had this apartment available, it's no big deal.
What about emotionally?
It just passes. I mean, it's a... By now, it's okay. I mean, it's just, I just go and I sleep over there and I come back the next morning, walk the dog, give the poodle its insulin shot, and the day starts again and it's forgotten. But it's strange, but it's no big deal. I go and then come back the next morning and life goes on.
The demands of family life call on our hearts and test our strength like almost nothing else, one teacher told me. As a young Catholic, I was inspired by the saints. I had always wanted to do things like work with Mother Teresa in India, but most of my life has not been so glamorous. After college, I became a teacher in an elementary school. And then my mother had a stroke, and I had to drop out of teaching. Help her for 2 years, bathe her, care for her bed sores, cook, pay the bills, run the house. At times, I wanted to complete these responsibilities and get back to my spiritual life. And then one morning it dawned on me, I was doing the work of Mother Teresa, and I was doing it in my own home.
So I'm riding across the park that same summer or several summers later, and I've come to Park Avenue, and I chained my bike up at the post in front of the building, and I walk into the building, and the doorman says, "You can't chain your bicycle to that. That's part of our awning. What are you doing?" I said, "Well, can I? I'm going to visit." "No, no. Do not chain your bicycle to our awning." So I chain my bicycle to, you know, a parking sign halfway down the block. And I come back with my Birkenstocks and my farmer pants, you know. And he looks at me like I'm a peasant, you know. And I take the elevator to the 13th floor.
Here you are, a guy experiencing existential despair, wearing Birkenstocks and farmer pants, as you put it, and no shirt. You're an idiot. I mean, you were.
Well, that's basically what she said.
Actually, you still are.
Obviously, you're not going to have much sympathy for this story because she reacted to my overalls the same way you did.
What did she say?
She said, "I can't believe you showed up for a therapy appointment wearing these overalls." I mean, I sat in her waiting room with all this pre-Columbian art, little statues, like, you know, it was like what your dream of Freud's waiting room would be. Little bulls and little weird little totems, you know, and little pieces of silver and... Very elegant. She smoked Pall Mall's nonstop. And she said, "Why did you feel the need to show up at my office wearing these clothes? And I said, "Well, I don't see what that has to do with any. That doesn't have anything to do with my problem. And she said, I think it has a great deal to do with your problem. You're a man in your early 30s who arrives in a psychologist's office wearing Birkenstocks and overalls.
She was suggesting it was disrespectful.
Disrespectful, but more so a sign of...
Some dysfunction.
Dysfunction. And she said, I can't help you. You know, you should have to help yourself.
I gave up fashion a few years ago after the second failed comeback here in the States. I couldn't deal with it anymore. And then I just sort of retreated to this room, which was good and bad. I mean, bad in that the bills started mounting. But I took care of those. You know, I had a pretty good year about 2.5 years ago.
Doing what?
An old friend of mine that I grew up with, she had called me from New York, where she was living at the time, and asked me if I would go down to Laguna to, she received a telephone call from a woman saying that her mother was just acting very oddly, and it turned out to be I went down there and committed her to a mental hospital.
Committed her mother to a mental hospital?
Yes. Yes, I did. When I got to the house, which is in a gated community, a very plush neighborhood of very manicured lawns, the whole thing. And you get to her house, and the place had huge placards on the lawn that she'd painted that made no sense at all. One had said, my friend came and visited me and stayed for 2 days.
You mean like little entries from a journal?
Yeah.
So then you went to the door and...
I went to the door and she was... Well, the door actually was wide open. And she, you know, the house was completely filled with trash. I guess she'd been subscribing to Soldier of Fortune magazine. She was covered in a camouflage tarp. It was a diaphanous mesh camouflage tarp of some kind. It was wearing as a cloak.
Mm-hmm.
And she had on 3 pairs of pajama bottoms, several belts, a sock on one foot, and she was barefoot on the other, a blindfold that she had taken and just put over her. I should also say that she had a brassiere around her neck, and she immediately spoke to me in sign language. It was a language that she had made up all of her own. She had a bat in one hand.
A bat?
A baseball bat, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And a knife in another hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it was difficult to move from room to room because of all the trash and the boxes and piles of books and newspapers and urine and...
Urine?
Yeah. And turds and what have you. We ordered a 25-foot stretch limousine to get her. Because if she saw an ambulance, that would signify that something was wrong. We got her into this limousine, took her to the hospital. By this time, she had on 3 blindfolds. I mean, she thought she was completely incognito.
Are you suggesting that she thought by putting a blindfold on her face that therefore nobody would be able to see her?
Exactly. And it took 5 orderlies, myself, this really confused doctor, and the chauffeur to get her chained down to a wheelchair and get her into this Unit 1, which is the heavy-duty flip-out unit. This was at St. Joseph's Hospital down in Orange. My friend left immediately back to New York, and I was left with the job of gutting the house, redesigning it and making it presentable for sale, because it was not only uninhabitable, it was unsaleable. It was completely ruined. quite a long time to take the house apart and put it in order. And as it turned out, the house sold for, I think it got the highest price that a house has gotten there for many years.
When we are confused or in pain, we often judge ourselves as not spiritual enough. But the awakened heart does not judge anything, not our family or our love, nor our pain and confusion, our passion or anger. "Terrible harm has been done by this misunderstanding," said one Catholic monk. He went on, "In mature spirituality, we are willing to have a dialogue with pain, with evil, to hold them in our prayers. In situations of great pain, someone has to consciously suffer the impact to become the ground where the sorrows can be held and reworked. These things can be carried with grace. The heart has to willingly hold the whole of suffering for it to be transformed." The truth is that in spiritual life, our awareness of suffering actually increases over the years. We see and know more deeply the sorrows of the world. We can no longer hide from their occurrence, and with this knowledge comes a deepening compassion. Whether we practice through Buddhist meditation, or as Jesus taught by turning the other cheek, or by finding the mercy of Allah, we must learn to forgive ourselves and others. Booker T. Washington said it simply, "Don't ever let them pull you down so low as to hate them." Forgiveness is the heart's capacity to release its grasp on the pains of the past and free itself to go on. It is in reconciliation and love of those closest to us that the spirit of our human family grows to widen and fully embrace our true family, all that lives.
Press 1. If it's a personal call, press 2. If it's a personal call with sexual overtones, press 3. If it's a business call with sexual overtones, press 4. If it's Joe Frank, get lost. If it's anyone else, hold on for a moment and I'll be happy to pick up.
Hello? Special message to you. In fact, I better remember to change it right now. Now, if someone else had called at that moment, it could have been an embarrassing situation.
One man, a military officer, who was studying meditation in a class for stress reduction, recently found this out at the supermarket. It was a crowded evening, the lines long, and the woman carrying a child in front of him had just one item but would not get into the express line. The officer, whose habit was impatience, began to get annoyed with her. It got worse when she got to the checkout stand and she and the clerk started cooing over the baby. The woman even handed the child to the clerk. He began to tense up, his anger building at the thought of how selfish she was. But because he had just come from his class, he noticed what he was doing to himself and began to breathe more softly and relax. He even noticed that it was a cute baby. By the time he got to the clerk, he'd let go enough to say, "That was a cute boy," Oh, thank you. That was my baby, she replied. You see, my husband was in the Air Force, but he died last year in a plane crash. Now my mother takes care of my boy and brings him in once a day so I can see him. We judge each other so quickly, yet know so little about what another carries in his or her heart. There is a traditional practice of meeting all beings as the Buddha, of seeing Christ in each of us. Rabbi Hillel called this simple understanding the summary of all the holy words, love God by loving your neighbor. It is expounded by Zen Master Dogen when he says, to be enlightened is to be intimate with all things.
You've been listening to Joe Frank, The Other Side. This program was called Four-Part Dissonance with Larry Block, Gregory Poe, Buddhist teacher Jack Kornfield, and Joe Frank. Production, Ray Guarna. Production assistants, Esme Gregson. Music consultant, Thomas Gulovich. In order to purchase cassettes of Jack Kornfield's lectures on Buddhism, call Sounds True Audio at 1-800-333-9185.